Ever watch a movie and wondered how they pulled off some incredible special effect?
How'd you do this?
For Luke Emrose, his life changed when he saw two movies nearly three decades ago.
The sort of pivotal moment where I knew what I wanted to do was when I watched Jurassic Park and then in quick succession, Terminator 2 came out.
Now, it's Luke's job to make those amazing things happen on the big screen. Luke is the technical lead for rendering at Animal Logic, and has been involved in some really big movies these past few years.
Projects that people may have seen is the Lego films, Peter Rabbit. We worked on Guardians of the Galaxy. We worked on Captain Marvel, Walking with Dinosaurs. So quite a few different projects over the years.
So why are we talking about movie making in a Maths and Stats podcast? Because Luke makes a lot of movie magic happen using tools from the mathematical sciences.
And so in most cases, it's generating imagery that is for things that don't exist in the real world. And in other times, it's to replace things that are too dangerous to do in the real world. It's like a literal physical simulation of exactly what happens using probability, geometry, mathematics, and art.
Luke hopes that this discussion may inspire students to study mathematics, statistics, physics, and computer science, and to convince some students in those subject areas to consider a career in computer graphics or film.
If somebody's listening to this and they've never considered that you could use a technical degree like probability or statistics in a field like film, I'm telling you that you can.
The power of maths and stats in movie making, this week on The Random Sample. Welcome to The Random Sample, a podcast by the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for Mathematical and Statistical Frontiers. I'm Emily DeWayne. In this show, we share stories about mathematics, statistics and the people involved. You can learn more about what the centre does by visiting our website, acems.org.au. That's acems.org.au. Our host is Dr. Melissa Humphreys, a lecturer in the School of Mathematical Sciences at the University of Adelaide and an ACEMS Associate Investigator.
Welcome to The Random Sample. My name is Melissa Humphreys. It's really great to have you here today, Luke. This is Luke Emrose, who actually went to the same high school as me, and I have found that he's doing some incredible stuff, so I'm really stoked to get the opportunity to speak to him today. Do you want to start, Luke, by just telling us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Luke Emrose and I'm the technical lead for rendering at Animal Logic. I think we can probably get into a bit more later about exactly what that means. But basically, my job is to take the vision of a director and then help to turn that into images at the end of a film. And so in most cases, it's generating imagery that is for things that don't exist in the real world. And in other times, it's to replace things that are too dangerous to do in the real world. So stunts or vehicle explosions that are too expensive or something like that. There's quite a wide variety of imaging that we do. Sometimes it's generating synthetic characters or synthetic objects. Other times it might be removing wires from a stunt double or something like that. So there's quite a wide variety from live action to fully computer animated work.
So one of the things that I've seen you do is that you worked on Peter Rabbit 2, is that?
Yes, that's great. Yeah, the one and two, yeah.
Yeah, awesome. So that's an example of the completely animated version that you would be involved with.
Correct, yeah. So that was what we call a hybrid feature. So that was shot at Centennial Park in Sydney. And then we added the characters as CG furry creatures, basically, over the top of the actors. So the actors would have, in many cases, a blue coloured puppet that they would interact with. So that leads to some very interesting kind of funny raw footage where someone's like screaming at a hand puppet or a sock puppet. And then we will go in and replace that with the actual character.
That is so awesome. So having gone to the same high school as you and knowing that, I mean, we were both kind of all right at mathematics, but we were both kind of more drawn towards artistic things when we were that age. The career that you have now really combines both of those things together. So
yes.
How did you find that pathway to this kind of end goal?
Well, I think that I started programming a computer when I was about 9 years old. I think I'd also had a very sort of deep love and interest in music, and I kind of found pretty quickly that they combined. So I used to write a lot of music on my computer, which was kind of like an artistic pursuit. I liked drawing, so I did a lot of like pencil drawing of all sorts of different things all the way through school, and then got into drama and performing and was it at Moorfar High School, I was in a barbershop quartet and all sorts of crazy things like this. Lots of fun though, and kind of found that the combination of art and technical was the most interesting to me. They kind of they bounced off of each other quite a lot. So I think the best way to describe it is that if you do one thing too much, it's pretty easy to get bored of it. But I tended to find that when I'd get bored of programming on the computer, or like it took too long, because you know, we're talking kind of late 80s, early 90s, everything took days, you know, like yes. The type of stuff that I do now, which takes minutes or hours, would have taken days to do back then. So, you know, if I tried to generate an image of a sphere or like a, you know, a plane or a torus, something very simple on my computer back then, I would like start at rendering, I would get on my bike, I would ride down to the local skate park for 9 hours, come home, and it would be like 20% finished. And so, you know, I guess my hand was forced that I'd have to do other things, just because, you know, it certainly, things weren't interactive back then with the computing power that you'd have at home. Whereas I think now computers are so fast that, you know, in some sense, there's no need to leave the computer, which is kind of, you know, has its detrimental effects. But back then, like, you know, I had to do other things. And so learning music, kind of tinkering around on a keyboard and a piano and stuff like that, was just a good way to pass the time while my images were rendering.
Yeah, that's so cool. This is what I remember most about high school, is actually the music and the barbershop quartet and everything. And you building like amplifiers or something to go on cars?
Yeah, so another hobby that I had was electronics, which I still kind of continue. And it was mostly geared towards music. So I think in primary school or high school? I think it was high school. It may have been primary school. They used to have this thing called the Oliphant Science Awards. I think it might have been in year eight I did that. And I think I won first, second, third place, I think it was, because I entered three different things. And I won a multimeter from Dick Smith for my entry. But basically, it was I built a 16-channel audio mixer, like a DJ mixer from scratch, just as kind of a learning project. And then I thought, well, you know, it works. I'll enter it in, and I won. And then I actually gave it to a friend of mine who still has it, and it still works like 15 years later. So
that's incredible.
It'd be more like 20 years now, actually. So yeah.
So from all of this, you ended up at the University of Adelaide doing maths and computer science.
Yeah.
You know, what was the goal when you did that, and how did you get from there to where you are?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think one of the things that I was very lucky about is that I think that having a direction pretty early in life to follow makes a lot of those things a lot easier. And for me, the sort of pivotal moment where I knew what I wanted to do was when I watched Jurassic Park, and then in quick succession, Terminator 2 came out. And those two films had a really strong effect on me, because unlike some people at the time, I knew that Jurassic Park, they didn't actually go out and shoot real dinosaurs. So I knew that they couldn't be real. And as a result, I was like, how did they do this? Like, how is this possible? Whatever it was they were doing, I kind of said to myself right then and there, like, I need to know how this works. I want to be involved in this. This is amazing. I remember how it felt at the cinema. I actually went to a drive-in to see that one, actually. And then with Terminator 2, it was a very similar idea of like just the innovation in that was involved in that, and the, you know, at the time, I think it's difficult to explain to a young person now the huge difference between everything that came before those films and everything that followed them. So like if you go to the cinema now, there's, I think the differentiation between films, like the innovation is more limited now because people are building on the groundbreaking work that was done back then. Mm-hmm. And so the impressiveness of films between each other has decreased over time. Like, you know what to expect in some sense. But when those films came out, nobody was expecting such a huge leap in quality.
Yeah.
And that just left such an impression. And that kind of made me think, well, if that's what I want to do, how do I get there? And so obviously there were two potential directions. One of them was to study art and kind of get into more the artistic side, which was my initial kind of, my initial idea was to do computer animation. So that's obviously a far more artistic than technical pursuit. I mean, there are technical aspects to it, but I think it would be considered more artistic. And so initially that's kind of what I thought I would do. But then I had such a strong interest and kind of background in mathematics and computer science already before I went to uni. I thought, well, my kind of thinking, and, you know, I think you could argue this in many different ways, my thinking was that the technical side is something that you can be taught, and the artistic side felt to me, depending on your views, you might disagree, like something that you either have or you don't have. And so I know that you can nurture the artistic side through formal education. But my feeling at the time was if I had to choose one of the two, it felt like going through the rigors of like formal learning for the technical would be more advantageous, because then at the end of that, I could potentially just continue my hobbies in the artistic side and develop those. And if it didn't work out, which I mean, at the time, I kind of thought it wouldn't work out because I didn't know anybody in the industry. My parents didn't, you know, I had no way of making that connection. And so kind of my plan was kind of a fallback, really. It was like, okay, I won't make it in this industry, so I'll study something I can do when I can't get into it. And it turned out that I did. But through a strange twist of fate, over the next sort of 15 years of working in film, I actually went from very artistic beginnings over the first few years and then slowly transitioning into basically a full-time developer, software engineer now. And can probably talk more about like how that happened and the transition, but you know, I've kind of gone through a lot of different roles within that industry, everything from kind of painting textures and like doing fine art with like, you know, brush stroking little details on different models for different films, to doing animation, to doing shader writing, which is basically sort of the mathematics behind the way that light bounces off surfaces. So kind of making things look like they should. So glass looking like glass or metal looking like metal. There's kind of a whole material science behind that stuff and how you define that on a computer. So surfacing is something I did for a long time. I did working on rigging, which is basically the technical process behind animation. So defining joints and bones and motion and the sort of the technical aspects of that, and then eventually go into the programming aspects of computer graphics. And then now in my role as technical lead for rendering, I'm pretty much doing physics for photons. So what I basically do is we take a 3D scene that has, you know, geometry which defines the shape, surface responses which define how the light bounces off the surface, and then we have virtual lights and we fire light into the scene, and the code that I write simulates the photons bouncing off of the surfaces, and then it uses probability theory to basically generate an image. So it simulates the sort of the randomness of surfaces and the way light bounces and reflects through things, and then eventually after lots of computation it gives you an image that hopefully looks indistinguishable from the real thing. And so my job is to take all of that data as an input, and then the software and the team that I'm leading designs the software that then simulates the light and generates the final frame that is used to to generate the images for the final film.
So, I mean, that is just absolutely phenomenal. I just want to explore a little bit the like mathematics and physics here. So, I've heard you say the words probability,
yes,
coding,
yes,
physics, yeah, like, you know,
all the things.
All the things. Yeah. So, you know, I guess I have two questions that I want to ask.
Sure.
The first one is kind of whether you can explore a little bit more, like there's what you did at uni that is helping you to do that.
Sure.
And the second thing is really for young people who might be like in high school thinking, wow, I'd love to work on some of these amazing, you know, films.
Mm.
You know, what do they do in high school that helps them to, like, you know, I just know like probability, sure, in high school was such a drag, you know, but, yeah, like, do you want to, like, is that important? And what do you use out of all of that, I guess, is my question.
Yeah, sure. Maybe I'll try and answer them in reverse order. So I feel like one of the ways to stop the sort of the formal side of education from being, you know, I guess a drag, would be basically to come up with ways to apply it to problems that are more interesting. So for instance, I think one of the advantages with learning to write computer code at an early age is that you could do things like say, you know, okay, I want to make a game where I have a square that shoots little lines at a triangle, right? And there goes 2 weeks of time trying to figure out all of the different issues with doing that. But in the process of doing something, a task like that, you are solving a lot of little micro problems which are related to you know, formal concepts like, you know, how do I draw a line? How do I draw a circle? You know, sine and cosine, all these sort of things. They're all related, but they're not related in such a way that they kind of cloud the process. Like what I think people need to do is they need to come up with an interesting thing that they want to do, and then they need to find ways to apply their knowledge to that thing to get there. And I think maybe sometimes with formal education, it's not entirely clear how you would do that. But I think one of the good things about a lot of the topics that I did at Adelaide University was that they did give us like kind of interesting topics. So one of the subjects I did was called fractal geometry. And so if you've ever seen those 80s, you know, electronic music video clips just full of fractals, you know all about kind of what they look like, but this was delving into how they're generated. And of course, I think when you tie a complicated concept to an interesting result, the process seems a lot less mundane, and it kind of immediately gets more interesting. And so I think I was always able to apply the math that I was learning at school to problems at home on my computer and generate images with them. So, you know, when it comes to probability, it might be, you know, sort of generating a probability curve from some concept and looking at an image of something. So I think for me, the natural combination of mathematics and imagery sort of, I guess, also helped lead me down a path of ending up in film, because it's kind of the ultimate combination of those two things. And so I think the advice that I'd have to anybody who's either at high school or studying would be that if you want to be really good at something, I think that you need to do the work that you know, the normal homework that you're doing, but it's certainly healthy to have a hobby that is related or extends that in some way, because even if you get 100% score and you're an A++ student for what you're assigned to, the reality is that there's so much more that you're going to be able to learn by applying it elsewhere. And so I think another thing that we look for when we hire people is a healthy interest in the topics, you know, outside of the formal training. And so, for instance, we had an applicant who implemented their own renderer themselves from scratch to render Lego bricks, and they'd seen the Lego movies, which we also worked on, and kind of showed, you know, that there was a bit more than just the basics there, that they'd kind of gone off and explored things themselves and learned new things. And I think the reason that's so important and interesting is because in some sense everything I do is new. So I wouldn't ever say that there's a case where there's a task that we get that we know how to do it. In most cases, we look at something and say, okay, this has never been done before. How are we going to tackle this? And I think that if you're only used to doing things that are on the page, or you're only used to exploring the concepts that are presented to you directly, and you're not kind of pushing those concepts to the next level, then I think that you're not going to get the full benefit of the education that you could find. And there are other subjects too at university that kind of highlighted this. So we did like an artificial intelligence was a topic, and one of the tasks was to make a maze solver to solve a maze in the dark, right? So you can imagine how you might solve a maze with computer vision, because you can see the corners. But imagine walking around in a dark room and you can only touch the wall. So the only thing that you have is the memory of where you've been. And if you touch the wall, you know that the wall's there, and you can infer that the wall probably extends to the left and the right of that, but maybe it doesn't, maybe there's a corner. So you can kind of, you can see things and then you can infer things, but then you have to try and, you know, extrapolate or guess what else is going on. And again, it's like a combination between a visual problem and a technical problem and sort of a little bit of personal experience, like what might be the case here. And so, you know, turning, for me, making problems visual has always been very useful. But I think that just extending what people are doing by applying them in different ways is really good advice, and that it'll put them in excellent stead for kind of applying whatever they learn to problems in the future when the problem they're trying to solve is not something that they've been taught before.
Describe a scene and how maths helps the animation to actually come alive. So what sort of mathematics do you use in that process?
Okay, so I can give you a specific example of something that I was involved in. So when we first got the brief for Peter Rabbit, we knew that obviously the characters would have a lot of fur. And at the time, so the renderer that I work on is called Glimpse, and it's called Glimpse because obviously it gives you a glimpse of, you know, what the final scene is going to look like. And so it seemed like a reasonable name. It wasn't taken, so we used that. And so in Glimpse, we didn't have any ability at the time to render fur because we'd just come off of three Lego films at the time. So we'd done the Lego Movie, Lego Batman, and then Lego Ninjago. And those films were obviously geared towards, you know, bricks, plastic. So we'd kind of designed a bunch of technology specifically targeting the visualization of billions of Lego bricks. And so it worked very well for that particular use case. And we developed the technology to kind of focus in on solving that problem as well as we could. But then moving on to something different, obviously this is uncharted territory. And so the first thing we did is investigate every piece of research that we knew we could find on how people had rendered fur in other renderers, looked at research papers, looked at nature documentaries and like nature research, and like researchers literally taking pieces of fur under microscopes and like looking at their structure. And what my task was for that film was to basically come up with a surfacing description of how fur interacts with photons. And so what I did was I made a model of a cylinder, which is basically representing a piece of fur. And so the three components of that is the cuticles are little pieces of scale that sit on the top of a hair follicle, and humans and animals have cuticles on the outside, and they bounce light and also refract light. And then on the inside of that is something called a cortex, which is basically made of like a pigment material, and humans and animals have a cortex. And the difference there is that on a rabbit, they have something called a medulla, which is like a second little cylinder, which sits on the inside of the cortex. And that is extremely diffractive. So like it makes light spread when it hits it. And so the reason that human hair looks shiny and like really sort of more, you know, it has that studio kind of look to it, especially when you put product in it, is because when the light goes through it, it doesn't diffuse very much. But when light hits an animal fiber, it hits this thing in the center called the medulla, and it scatters. And so that's why animal fur has this really kind of, simultaneously it looks sheeny, but it also looks soft. And so that's the kind of look that we needed to sell the rabbits as being realistic. And so what I did was, there was a set of research that was done by three different researchers into how you would model the path of a photon through a hair fiber. And so it obviously, it can, probability dictates that some of the photons, they bounce off the cuticle, some of them penetrate the cuticle and enter the cortex, some of them bounce off the medulla, some of them enter the medulla. And so we basically said, okay, each photon has a probability. What is the probability of it bouncing off or going through? And then we make a decision about which one it does. And then on the next bounce, we say, we've got a probability of entering the medulla or bouncing off of it, and so on and so forth. So we compute the probability of taking every possible path through the hair. And then we say, let's say that, you know, there's 10% of doing this, a 20% are doing this, and a 70% are doing this. And then we randomly choose between one of those based on the weights. And that's what the ray trace is doing. So the software that I work on, Glimpse, will, every time it hits an object, it will compute a bunch of probabilities and then randomly choose one based on that probability. And the result of that will be something that looks like, a furry rabbit, because it's using the physics of what a photon would do in the real world if it actually did the same thing. So it's a physical, it's like a literal physical simulation of exactly what happens using probability, geometry, mathematics, and art.
That's incredible. And so do you do this like computation for each hair on the rabbit?
So it's for each photon that hits. So yeah, that's correct. That's correct. So it depends how you think about it. So the lights, okay. So the way it works is that there's a couple of concepts here. So the first one is that light is bidirectional. What that means is if I shine a light in a mirror in one direction and it bounces, if I replace the camera with the light and replace the light with the camera, it's reciprocal. It does the same thing in both directions. So there's no difference between putting a light source and a camera, or putting the camera and the light source. You can swap them interchangeably and the result is the same. So what we do is, if you imagine in the real world, you have lights and they emit photons and they bounce through the scene and then they hit a camera. But that's really expensive because those photons may not hit the camera, and that's a lot of wasted computation. So what we do is we swap the light and the camera, and we fire the rays through the camera instead, relying on the fact that mathematically it's the same thing. And so we fire a bunch of rays through the camera, we bounce them around the scene, and then we let them hit the lights. And then we compute the probability in the other direction. So that's kind of how a renderer works. You have an image that's made of pixels, and each pixel, you fire a ray through the pixel, it bounces around the scene, you know, bouncing off all of the surfaces, and it eventually hits a light. And when it hits a light, you record the energy that goes through that path, and that generates an image.
That is just phenomenal.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
That is so cool. Like, I know that you said that you saw like movies and were like, oh, I'd like to do that. But did you ever think that you would actually do this for a job? Like,
no. It was hard to know. It was hard to know what to expect at that point. I mean, I knew that I wanted to do it, but I think that's another thing to kind of mention here about opportunities for students, is that I don't think a lot of people even realize this is a thing, right? Like, it's not obvious that this is a job. So, you know, to kind of put it in simple terms, you can work in the film industry in Australia, both in Adelaide and in Sydney, for companies that that, you know, work on visual effects for films. There's opportunities for people who are interested in technical pursuits like mathematics, physics, probability theory, geometry. There's also opportunities for people who are artists, who are interested in performing. So you can do animation as a performer, even things like music. You know, there's a lot of different fields. And I think that, and unless you've stayed back and watched the credits of a movie to realize how many humans are involved in the pursuit of constructing something like a film, then you'll get a sense of just how much horsepower or human power is required to do it. And so, you know, there's a lot of different jobs in a lot of different areas in the film industry, especially in the STEAM field. So, you know, like science, technology, engineering, arts, mathematics, they're all covered. So it's definitely something, if somebody's listening to this and they've never considered that you could use a technical degree like probability or statistics in a field like film, I'm telling you that you can.
And, you know, like, I do want to just add here, like, I mean, that is so spot on and so right. And neither of us have come from very lofty or illustrious backgrounds, really. And yet here you are doing incredible things. Like, your where you start is not the important thing here. It's just like tenacity and hard work.
Yes. And yes, that's right. Yeah, it's definitely about hard work. And just like, I think for me, the thing that drives me is just, I'm really interested in problem solving. And I think that the reason that I do what I do is because it has the hardest problems. And so it combines so many different things, like a lot of unknowns, which I'm really attracted to, sort of this idea of solving unknown problems, or like doing things that people haven't done before. I mean, even though, you know, obviously, as Einstein said, that everyone stands on the shoulders of giants, but like, you know, it's not like I'm really doing anything that's going to necessarily, you know, change the world per se, but sometimes we do things that are original and they're the first time they're done, and that's fun. And there's always the chance that, you know, the next thing that you do will be groundbreaking in some way. And so the scale of the problems and the problems to be solved has always been the thing that drives me. And you know, I think, yeah, like, I didn't think I fully grasped what that meant for a long time. But I'm certainly not going to argue that it's a lot of fun. It's very cool. But the reason that I got to this point is because it just looked like a really interesting problem to solve. And there's just an infinite number of them to solve.
Do you think you could do the job that you're doing now if you hadn't have studied mathematics and or computer science?
So, I mean, I know that I work with people that haven't and they can. So I think it is possible. What I would say is it really depends on the exact thing you're trying to target. So in my case, I don't think it would have been as easy, or nor do I think I probably could have gone as far in my career without it. I probably would have had to go on back and studied more. Having a really strong basis in computer programming, like in my case in C++, is really important. And, you know, the formal training that I had in that certainly helped. I dabbled at home. I knew some stuff, but it wasn't really until I was shown it in a formal setting that I think it took off. Had I known some of the content and could have done it at home, possibly, but I wouldn't have because I didn't, so probably not. I think even things like statistics, it's pretty hard to explain what a huge change there's been in the last 10 years in computer graphics, from doing things in a very geometric sense. So, you know, like mirrors reflecting things, you know, this vector reflects off this plane in this direction, is pretty much that was kind of the extent of innovation. Now, most of computer graphics is based on research that happens at CERN. So, you know, like the Large Hadron Collider, they're finding, you know, the ways that the electrons bounce through surfaces, things like that. That sort of research now drives a lot of what we do, and it's all based on probability theory. So, you know, most of what we do is when a photon hits the surface and it bounces with a distribution. So, you know, light, when it bounces off a rough surface, it's very bumpy. And so the angle that it leaves the surface is kind of a distribution. It might be like a teardrop shape of the way the ray expands as it leaves the surface. And a lot of what we're doing is choosing the right direction to leave so that the image looks like it would in real life. And so you use probability theory to kind of describe the shape of that reflection, but also to sample it efficiently. And so sampling and statistical theory is like, it drives everything, like, and every innovation in computer graphics now, whereas in the past, it would have been very much geometry and like more pure mathematics. Mm. But, you know, it kind of surprised me in some sense, the kind of the seismic shift from very kind of pure geometry to extremely deep statistical analysis that is going on now. And if you look at the latest research all across games and rendering, it's dominated by statistics.
That's very cool for me. I love my statistics. Yeah. The people are pretty good too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, when you dedicate your life to something, you can't help but kind of be find enjoyment in it. So if you're working in an environment that you love, you're going to be a happy person.
Yeah.
And that's quite rare these days, I think. You know, rocking up to work and enjoying it seems to not, you know, necessarily be something that everyone has. So it's nice. It's a really nice feeling to work with people who love doing what they do.
That's very cool. What part of your degree were the most and least helpful in getting you to where you are?
I know this is going to sound very cliche, but I think that the idea that anything was the least help. I think there was one. So I did a subject called integration and analysis, and I'm not going to say it wasn't of any help, but it was probably among the least of the help that I had because it was so theoretical. I think it was also the worst score that I got out of my entire degree, but my lecturer was awesome. So that one probably not so much. Most, I think that fractal geometry was just so much fun and really allowed me to sort of see the beauty of mathematics and all the different ways it could be applied. And being scored on how awesome your fern or your Mandelbrot set was a totally interesting concept to me at a university level. So that was pretty cool. The introduction to C++, obviously super useful, and I use it every day. Everything to do with statistics, pure maths. I also did physics electives at uni, which I think really helped me to square the physical reality of the processes that I'm modeling. So like a lot of what I'm doing is modeling real life things, mostly photons. And so having an understanding of physics at the sort of the wave particle duality level, which is kind of where you start in first year physics, I think it's something that I use all the time. And then another really important one in the computer science syllabus is called data structures and algorithms. And I think that's like, without question, the most important. Like if you don't pay attention in that one, you're going to find it hard to get a job, certainly with my team. But it just the basis of, you know, tree structures on computers and search structures, they're so fundamental that, like, in some sense, they're the language that everything we do is based on. And, you know, they're so important. And I hadn't really had a lot of exposure to that through my projects at home. And so learning about that has made a massive difference because, you know, a renderer in some sense is built upon a lot of data structures and then search structures to search through that data for various things. And, you know, it's just so fundamental. So quite a lot of it was good, and a little bit of it might have been less useful, but I would say I got pretty lucky and everything I studied has been very useful on some level.
So of our mathematicians, when they start their degree, there is always kind of a subset that feels that the coding stuff we get them to do in their Bachelor of Mathematics is not, you know, the most important part of their degree. Mm-hmm. Can you say something to how important, I know you've already sort of spoken about this a bit, but can you say something to how important you think, like, having computational ability and, you know, the ability to be able to use a computer is to finding a career in mathematics?
Well, I mean, if somebody said to you, okay, now check pi to 3 billion decimal places by hand, I think that's probably a point at which having some ability with a computer is useful. So I think it really depends on exactly what you're doing. So I would argue that in the modern sense, a lot of theorems actually end up being proven by computers, not by people, because of the rigor that a computer can use. Like, for instance, you can use computers now with formal languages to prove rules or to prove theorems by checking rules in a way that a human would be able to make mistakes. And so whether it's pure mathematics, in which case you're trying to validate that your theorem is correct, or when it comes to applied, where, you know, there's an inescapable connection between computation and applied mathematics these days. Because, for instance, if you're trying to do something like a partial differential equation simulation or something like that, doing that by hand, let's face it, is like kind of pointless when you've got a computer to do it for you. And it kind of allows you to then focus on the process rather than the computation, which I think is the more interesting part. And the other thing is that if you're going to then do anything other than academia, like if you're going to get a job in an industry, you're going to probably need to program a computer to do something with that concept at some stage. And even in academia, like I said, there's like obviously using them to check things, but there's also using them to generate, you know, everything from generating the data in your reports or your graphs. You know, there's at least a very basic computer requirement there. So I think that the answer to that would be, how would that person think that they would be able to just use pieces of paper and pens to draw mathematical equations, and then not, what are they going to do, like take photos of them and put those in their final paper? I don't think so. Like, it's at the very least, they're going to need to use some desktop publishing, which is using a computer. Much more likely, they're going to need to use it for a lot of grunt work, for checking things or doing brute force calculations or something like that. So they might not see the application immediately, but yeah, it's definitely useful. And it makes it more fun, I would say. Like, when every new language is scary and confusing, but when you've learned a few of them, the new ones don't seem so bad. And so learning a computer language is terrifying at first, but it's very empowering once you've done it. And if you take it step by step, and you'll get there eventually, and it'll just open up the number of things you can do quickly.
What's on the horizon for you? What new and interesting projects can you tell us about?
It turns out that there's four projects I can tell you about. So we have two offices, one in Vancouver and one in Sydney, that do the actual production. We have a third office in LA, which deals with the generating the scripts and the intellectual property. And so in Vancouver, we currently have a project which is wrapping up this year and coming out in 2022, which is called Super Pets, which is based on a DC Comics, the original comics of the pets for the superheroes and what they get up to. So it's pretty cool. So we're doing an animated feature for that, which is well into production. We're working on a project called Toto, which has Alex Timbers directing, and he just cleaned up at the Tony Awards for Moulin Rouge, the musical. So we're pretty excited to be working with him. We're working in Sydney on a project called The Magician's Elephant, which I'll provide a link for in the podcast link to read more about that project. And then we also have Ron Howard's first animated feature. We're working with him on a project called The Shrinking of the Treehorns, which is based on a book. And so that'll be an animated feature. So we're looking forward to that as well. So lots of interesting stuff going on. And there'll be other ones as well that I can't tell you about, but they're the ones I can. And the projects that people may have seen is as I mentioned before, the Lego films. You mentioned Peter Rabbit. We worked on Guardians of the Galaxy. We worked on Captain Marvel. So quite a few different projects over the years. Walking with Dinosaurs, and yeah, it's quite a lot of different things.
That's so cool. What is the craziest project that you've worked on?
I worked on the film Australia, the Baz Luhrmann film, and I spent almost a year pretty much with him traveling around Australia from Bowen in Queensland up to Darwin, And my job on that was actually something called previz. So what I would do is I'd have a laptop and I would basically follow him around wherever he was, whatever time of day it was. Sometimes it would be during the day, sometimes it'd be 3 a.m. at nighttime on a set with Hugh Jackman and Nicole Kidman. And I would, using a laser pointer and some kind of basic trigonometry, I would run out to the set in the morning. I would find out what was constructed. I would build a 3D model of it in a couple of hours. And then I would take photographs and project them onto the model to kind of build an idea of the set. And then I would work with Baz directly to figure out, okay, how many actors do we need? Which direction is the camera going to be in? How high is the camera? Do we need a camera on a crane? Do we need a camera in a helicopter? How are we going to shoot this? What lens are we using? So we would figure out all of the shots in advance. And then the next day they would shoot that setup. And then we would know exactly how many actors to hire for which days. We would figure out which direction the sun was going to be on. So like on this particular day, we would be able to match this particular part of the script. And so kind of the craziest thing I got to do in that was we had to figure out how to replicate a shot that we'd pre-visualized on the computer for a helicopter. And so we had to calculate using Google Earth to plot out the points. And then we turned the points into GPS coordinates. And then I fed a set of GPS coordinates to a helicopter pilot who programmed them into a computer on the helicopter that flew through the points. And then when we compared the footage from the helicopter pilot to what we'd done on the computer, it was exactly the same. And so that was nuts. That was a lot of fun. And so, you know, like combining all these things, geometry and kind of, you know, basic idea of GPS coordinates and trying to figure out the direction the helicopter would be in and say, you have to go through these points at, you know, intervals of 30 seconds. So I want you to hit this one, then 30 seconds later, I want you to hit this one. And if you fly the helicopter at that speed, you'll get the same shot. And sure enough, it was one of the opening sequences for the film where you're flying into Darwin Harbour. It worked out perfectly. And so that was a lot of fun, very, very crazy time, but awesome. So that was kind of the one of two times where I've had the chance to visit a set while they're shooting. The other one was on Peter Rabbit in when they were shooting that, and we got to kind of walk around the set and have a look at how everything was constructed. And it's those people are amazing. The work that they do to build the sets and make everything look like it does is just incredible.
Yeah, bit different to the old Rocker Steppards.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, but surprisingly similar as well.
That's amazing. I love that must have been so high pressure as well, having to, I feel like that's almost like a maths exam, like under pressure, on the time, you must know like the velocity of this helicopter flying through this set of coordinates, like.
Yeah, so I think the thing to say there is that that's a classic example where like you're flying into a problem relatively blind, and the only things that you have to rely upon is the things that you've learned and then extrapolating things to try and figure out things you don't. So, you know, like obviously, you know, to figure out where something is, you can use triangulation. So, you know, from geometry that if you've got three directions, you can draw a circle that explicitly finds that point, draw three circles, they only cross at one point or very close to one point. That allows you to figure out where that point is. And so if you've got a laser pointer and you're running around a set, you can just take three measurements, figure out exactly where you are from those as reference points. And pretty quickly you can build a, you know, a 3D or a 2D map of the thing that you're looking at with nothing but, you know, one distance measure, a little bit of mathematics and a little bit of time and a computer, and boom, you can do something like that. So it's
amazing, like a lot of fun. Faster movie output.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Pretty crazy stuff, yeah. But you know, there's people, you know, a lot of people on a set doing all sorts of things. You know, the guys who the focus pullers are kind of the most crazy ones to me. So they basically measure the distance from the lens to the subject, and they tell the cameraman how to adjust the focus as the shot is progressing so that it's perfectly in focus the whole time. And the precision that those guys work with is just mind-blowing. Because, you know, I'm doing stuff on a computer, so it doesn't get anything wrong. And if it makes a mistake, it's my fault. But when you're working with the physical stuff, you know, it's all down to their precision as people. They know what the math is, they know how to do it, but they have to, you know, do it by rotating something by hand most of the time. So full respect to them. The stuff I was doing was pretty easy in comparison.
That's pretty hardcore. It's amazing how much mathematics there is in filmmaking.
Actually. Oh yeah. Big time. So lots cool. of it. Lots of it. Yeah.
Hopefully this podcast will reach the next generation of budding film awesomeness people.
Well, I certainly hope so.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to us about all the amazing stuff that you're doing. I'm still completely amazed and in awe of all the things that you're doing. It's so cool.
My pleasure. It was absolutely awesome. Thank you very much.
You'll want to head to the episode page for this podcast. We have heaps of bonus material, including some more clips from Luke's interview and a lot of information about Animal Logic where Luke works. That includes job openings and even some open source production quality data for you to download, inspect, learn from and contribute back to. Go to asims.org.au/podcast and click on episode 61. Thank you for listening to The Random Sample, a podcast brought to you by the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for Mathematical and Statistical Frontiers. If you like what you heard, please rate us on iTunes, because we think stories about maths and stats are worth sharing, and we want others to discover that as well. You can learn more about what we do at asems.org.au. That's acems.org.au. And you can find us on social media by searching at Ace Math Stats. That's at ACE Math Stats. We'll see you next week with another story from within ASIMS. Bye for now.